This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flato. We're broadcasting today from the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science here in San Diego, and I'm sure I may be preaching to the choir here when I say that science is an important part of our daily lives. But, you know, when you watch those broadcast and cable talk shows last December where they reviewed the big news stories of the year, did you hear anyone talk about the Large Hadron Collider, the Mars rover, the nanotechnology, dinosaurs, hominids, hundreds of other major science stories of the year? Did you hear any of those mentioned on any of these shows? You know, from climate change to agriculture to the latest medical advances, we all know that science is everywhere, everywhere that it is, except on TV news or in the shrinking pages, science pages of your newspaper. And while science themes are showing up more and more in movies and television shows, think Lost, CSI, The Big Bang Theory, it seems harder to get accurate, unbiased science and technology news anywhere. Well, maybe it's time to start looking somewhere else and where the other news sources are going. So that place might be the internet, the blogs, Facebook, Twitter, social networking. Can these sites fill in the science news void? And can scientists and science writers do more to advance the case for science news? That's what we'll be talking about this hour. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK, and you can always Twitter us. Send us a tweet at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We'll see if we can get a tweet in or two. And also in Second Life, you can join the folks in Science Friday Island out there who will be sending us stuff also. And if you're here in the audience, I invite you to step up to the mics on the aisles there and don't shove. So please be nice to one another. I'm sure you always are. Let me introduce my guest. Deborah Blum is a Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer. She is a professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her newest book, just out this week, is called The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. Sounds interesting. We'll have to have you on to talk about that.
I'd love to do that.
Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks
for being here. Paul Rayburn is no stranger to Science Friday. He sits in for me every once in a while. He's a science writer. He blogs for the Knight Science Journalism Tracker and a blog spot called True Slant. He's also the organizer of the annual New Horizons in Science Conference, and his forthcoming book is called Why Fathers Matter. Welcome back to Science Friday, Paul.
Thanks, Ira.
As Stephen Schneider. Dr. Schneider is a climatologist at Stanford. He's also the winner of the collective Nobel Peace Prize, which he shared with Al Gore and others in 2007. His new book is Science as a Contact Sport, Inside the Battle to Save Earth's Climate. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira.
Jane Stevens is the Director of Media Strategies for the World Company. That's the parent company of Lawrence Journal World and News. Last time we talked with Jane Stevens, she was on in Antarctica on an icebreaker ship about 10 years ago.
That's
like that, right.
Right.
She was reporting on tonight. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks, Ira.
I said Lawrence World Journal and Six News.
Yes.
Let me correct myself. Well, tell us about what that is. Let me begin with you, Jane. What is that site all about, and why did you start that site?
Well, actually, I came to the World Company last June because they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, which was to actually figure out a way to make journalism survive and thrive and relevant in this new web world that we're going into. So part of that is a structure that we're creating, a new content management system, and we're going to be launching a beta version of that this coming week, and it's about health. It's called WellCommons, and we're integrating social media with journalism in a brand new revolutionary way that we think will actually make science more popular.
Well, let's talk about it. How do you ensure, if people are sending stuff in, how do you ensure that it's accurate science or there's accurate news coming in there?
We've engaged the health community in Lawrence, tiny little town in Lawrence, Kansas, the blue spot in the red state, and in Douglas County, and they've been helping us and participating in this. So they will each have their own group pages on there, and they're responsible for the accuracy of their pages, as we are responsible for the accuracy of ours. Mm-hmm. So it's like fractals. It's groups within groups within groups.
Mm-hmm. Paul Rayburn, you in the Knight Tracker follow a lot of these new media blogs. Are they successful at vetting what they're putting out there?
Well, I think they are, but it's hard to tell. I can tell you one story. A couple of months ago, I saw a very interesting story about a woman who died in jail in Vermont, who had anorexia and apparently needed potassium supplements and knew she did and pleaded for them. It was really well done. Story of a kind that we're familiar with in newspapers. It was a site called vtdigger.com or vtdigger.org. Mm-hmm. So what the heck is that? You know. So I normally just write in the tracker about what I see on the page, but in this case I emailed the reporter and I said, "Who are you guys?" And it turns out there are a lot of former newspaper people, and it seems to be a legitimate news site on the web. The problem is, it's hard to tell that. You have to do a little bit of research, mm-hmm. and roam around and see. It's possible in a few years from now, anybody who follows Vermont News will know vtdigger.org is a great site. But we're in this transition point now where it demands a lot of the reader to figure out what you're looking at and can you trust it.
Right. Deborah Blum, you've been around for decades writing science news and starting out in newspapers. I've been around that long, too. So
I'm thinking I'm old.
How have you kept track of the changing, shifting landscape of all of this?
Well, I teach journalism, and so I have to say to myself, I'm not going to teach my past. It's not interesting to me, and what interests me about the changing landscape of journalism is the opportunities that I hope it has for us to do things better, to find different audiences, to approach people about science in different ways. It allows us to build new voices, mm-hmm. and I try to teach that, and I try to do it myself.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Schneider, you have been very vocal about your criticism about how the climate situation has been covered. What bothers you the most about all?
Ira, as you know, when you said in the beginning, how do we get accurate information? I actually don't like to use the word because science is not in the world business of total accuracy. The worst oxymoron I know of is exact science. What we do is we approximate. So you take a complicated problem like climate, you have to break it down to the same components you would in health or in military or in other complex systems into well-established bits, you know, the parts that are competing explanations and the speculative. What I've been so annoyed about is this dumbing down polarization into kind of end of the world and good for you extremes, all have PhDs. How can the public be anything but confused? In fact, end of the world and good for you, the two lowest probability outcomes. What we do is we provide bell curves with multiple outcomes, and our job is to winnow out the relative probability of these. And lately, I have actually been, you know, reading about this IPCC gate. It's frankly a fraudulent frame. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, indeed is a human institution. You know, it's 200 scientists. It goes through multiple rounds of review. It's people from all over the world. It's got to have mistakes. That's not the problem. The problem is when it makes a few mistakes, and these mistakes were discovered largely by the well-oiled multi-million-dollar disinformation engines and the Competitive Enterprise Institute and other things, they pointed it out. You know what? They have a right, and they should have. IPCC, I think, badly responded by calling the ones who pointed it out voodoo scientists. That's ridiculous. What you have to say is, thank you, we'll check it. Mm-hmm. When we checked it, two or three of those errors were really bad. What they didn't say, and this is the fraudulent part, is how can you report just a few mistakes and not report the overall track record of the group? It's a man bites dog story. So here's the temple of, you know, intellectual science caught in a few errors, and indeed they are. But not to say that when there's 1,000 conclusions and no matter how hard the guys search from the other side, they've only found 3 wrong. My view is, give me a crack team, I could probably find 10.
Paul, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. One of the things that, the things I look at in the tracker are sometimes just the standard. Some of the issues in the new media are the same issues in the old media, mm-hmm. Which is to just do things accurately and to avoid the kind of, which often comes up in climate, not exactly what Stephen was talking about, but the, you know, he said, she said, right. quote the the deniers who dug up the errors equally with the IPCC and so forth. But you find the same kind of mistakes all the time in all kinds of coverage. There was another post I'd done that said, women who are depressed during pregnancy are likely to have more aggressive kids when the kids are 10 years old. yow, that's a good story, and frightening. And that's a long time to worry and wait till your child grows up to be 10 to see how bad he or she is. But it turns out the study was done on, you know, a very low socioeconomic group in tough neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. You might guess that there would be other explanations for why the kids have problems, but most of the reporting didn't point that out. It just stated it flatly like I did at the beginning. And we just see these things. They're the old errors in the new media.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, is that because there aren't as many science reporters around as there used to be, or they're just not paid, or what?
I think that's
Or is there a political agenda?
Well, I don't see conspiracies behind every problem in science journalism. There aren't as many trained science writers as there used to be. Some of that's been the downsizing, especially in this country. You could go to other countries and see that they're starting to grow new generations of science journalists. I agree with Paul that a lot of what we're looking at are problems that have been around for a while that have simply transferred over. And I think one of the bigger problems is that when you look at the vast landscape of the Internet, it's really hard to tell who the carefully vetted sites are from the ones that someone is just thinking about an issue and getting it out there in a random way.
All right, we're going to have to take a break and come back and talk more with Deborah Blum and Paul Rabin, Stephen Schneider, Jane Stevens, all talking about the state of science journalism today. Our number 1-800-989-8255. If you're in the audience and you want to ask a question, don't be afraid to step up to the microphone because we have a lot of time to step up there and ask your question. Also, if you're on Twitter, you can send us a tweet. We have some tweets coming in. And also, you can give us a call by the phone, and don't be afraid to ask questions. We're going to be talking about climate change and about how and all the science issues and how scientists deal with them in the media. I'll give you the number again. 1-800-989-8255 is our number, and also you can tweet us at SCIFRI. That's at SciFry. And surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, and you'll be able to leave us a message. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. Don't go away. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. We're here at the American Association for the Advancement of Science annual meeting in San Diego, and we're talking about how science writers and scientists and get the news out to the public. Our number 1-800-989-8255. My guests are Deborah Blum, professor of journalism, University of Wisconsin in Madison; Paul Rabin, science writer, and he blogs for the Knight Science Journalism Tracker; Stephen Schneider, climatologist at Stanford; and Jane Stevens, director of media strategies for the World Company. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to questions. Let's start on this side of the room. Yes.
Thank you. Do you want us to identify ourselves or just talk?
It's up to you. Do you want to get bad mail? You want to stay anonymous. Give us your first name if you
I'm
want.
I'm Maggie from the University of New Mexico. But anyway, you brought up a very important point, and it is the problem with the signal-to-noise ratio. It's affecting all of you, I can see. It's also affecting us.
That's an old engineering term that a lot of people may not understand.
Well, I work with a lot of engineers and love them dearly, and but I'm a biologist. But the bottom line is that I can see with the scientific literature there's also this signal-to-noise problem. And what concerns me the most, and what I've heard from some of you, is that when that happens, what system do we all tend to rely on? We rely on who we know. And so what I see is a resurgence of this, no offense, but it's sort of an old boys network, and it can also include women, you know, where people, for instance, if you're at Princeton, you know what people at Harvard and all the people that you're seeing at meetings are doing. But when people are at smaller institutions, they become lower and lower on the horizon. And so the question is, how do we develop tools or methods, you know, sort of meta-level methods, sort of the way Cisco developed or Google or something, that will help us improve our signal-to-noise ratio. I don't know if it's possible.
All right, let me.
We have to be at least cognizant.
Let me see if we can translate the question first.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm worried about diversity in the age of a poor signal-to-noise ratio.
Signal-to-noise ratio. I'm from my old engineering days. It's like getting the good stuff out of where it gets very noisy. Any suggestions? Deborah, you have any? When people ask me, how do I trust something, who do I trust? I say, you know, it's sort of like a movie review. You know, you find people who do good science reporting or newspapers or bloggers or whatever, and then you go sort of trust those sorts of people who've got experience. Deborah, you have any suggestions?
For finding your reliable source?
So what are we all going to do? We're all in this position. You're in this position. Mm-hmm. I'm in this position. You know, what's a sort of meta-level solution that you have maybe thought about for identifying reliable sources and allowing new sources to be heard?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, especially in the internet age, I find that I never trust one source. And so whereas I used to read one newspaper, every morning I get up and I scan online six or seven or more than that, and I'll find myself saying, this story is done better here, or I wonder what is happening with the coverage of this story overseas. So then I go look overseas. One of the things I think that the new sort of deluge of information forces us to do is to really look at multiple angles, because you and I both know that no story is single-faceted. There's never one voice that tells the entire truth. And so one of the advantages of today over the sort of bottleneck we used to have of getting our news from only a few places is that if we're smart about it, we can really do a kind of sophisticated analysis of what's out there.
Jane, how do you, on your new venture, how are you going to get those trusted sources?
You build community, and the people who are part of that community obviously are the ones who are moving things forward, or sometimes backward, as the case may be. But if you engage them and give them the same tools that journalists have, and then raise the community standards so you're trying to create a safe place and a trusted source, I think you have a better solution for that. Now, I've been a science journalist for a really long time, and one of the things that I saw was exactly this issue. The signal-to-noise ratio was a big deal. So this system that we've created, I think, has a shot at making that an easier thing to manage.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, what about politics in all of this? We all bring it with us, don't we, when we look at issues in science?
Nobody, including scientists, is entirely free of bias. The way we try to suppress our bias is through a peer review system. And science has sometimes a tough time in the street because science is not a democracy. It's a meritocracy. Your ideas have to have evidence. And while we have, so in our world, quality trumps equality. A lot of people don't trust us because there's an entry barrier to get in. But remember, science has two components. There's risk, what can happen multiplied times the odds. That's the science part where we fight it out. Mm-hmm. And then there's risk management, what to do about it. That's the political part. That's value judgments, which scientists have only one vote, just like everybody else. But if people are uninformed about the risk part because they've been so knocked off their pins by this false balance debate, then it's hard for them to apply their values. And they either do quote who they trust, which unfortunately for a third of this country is those famous, you know, climate professors, Professors Beck and Limbaugh, and, you know, whose everything they say is utter nonsense or worse. And it does lead to a serious paralysis. The one thing we have to remember in signal to noise is that there are some components, as I said earlier, that are well established. There is a strong signal to noise, but a large fraction of complex system science still is a signal to noise neutral kind of event, and that may have significant outcomes. People need to know about that.
How do you get scientists to talk to the media?
Okay, just one last thing. I always tell my students, watch out for the myth busters and the truth tellers. Listen to the people who are apologizing about talking in ranges and caveats. They're so much more qualified than these blogsters with the truth. How do you get scientists involved? Well, unfortunately, what's going on now is only getting them less involved, because when they see what they say either getting distorted or ignored, and they see this polarized debate, they just go back to the bench. That's the wrong decision. Mm-hmm. I think you get them engaged by showing them that they have an obligation to explain their field. But one more thing, scientists often think that when the media call them, they want to know about their little irrelevant detail. No. Our job is to relate the nature of the field when we have a deep understanding of it. It is not our job to represent ourselves, but our field. And if they really care about what you do specifically, do that. That's going to be a tough nut to crack in science.
Let's go to the audience right here. Yes, step up.
Hi, my name is Dagnia, and I'm at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, and I want to ask your help. I've got scientists who want to talk to the media. I have scientists who are engaged in doing great things in cancer research, neuroscience, and plant biology. What do I, Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, as a content provider, what do I need to do to get you to listen and you to help relay the messages about the great discoveries that are going on?
Jane, can you help this person out?
I would say not only, more important is actually building your own community that supports what you're doing. I think that a lot of scientists haven't done that. We haven't had the tools to do that, for one thing. But Hubble was a great example of how to do that. For NASA has been pretty good about telling people what's going on. And Hubble, I mean, I don't know how many of you have the screensaver of, you know, some beautiful galaxy or a widget or whatever on your computers, but it became part of people's life, so that when NASA said, no, we're going to scrap it, we're not going to repair it, there were thousands and hundreds of thousands of people who were very angry about that and let their policymakers know. So building that community is the first start, I think. I think that the traditional media is becoming less relevant, but the community that you build is going to become more relevant.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Paul, there's this phrase about news on the internet that it's, quote, self-correcting. I mean, is it really self-correcting?
Well, of course it is. You just have to read an infinite number of websites, and then you're all set. You've got the truth. I mean, I think you know, one of the issues I was going to suggest with regard to getting messages out and signal-to-noise ratio is, you know, I would recommend that people, you know, get an RSS reader. If you don't know what that is, Google RSS reader, and you get 10,000 explanations of what it is, how to use it, how to set it up, and subscribe to all the websites you can think of and everything you find, and read them, and after a period of time, you'll find that you're not looking at some, you don't trust them, you don't like them, you'll find that some become favorites. The reason that we, you know, pick your favorite newspaper. It's always fun to beat up on the New York Times. So the New York Times, which is probably, you know, certainly the best newspaper in the country and the one that professionals like us especially love to hate and criticize and debate and so forth. But the reason we have feelings about the Times, we trust them or we know where we don't trust them, is they've been around a long time. We've been reading them for a long time. We're familiar with them. It's the same thing with the websites. Read a lot, look at a lot, waste some time, and eventually you'll settle in on the things that are delivering the message that you're looking for.
Here's a question from Second Life, from Silverwing Benoit, who says, which country has the best coverage of science in their news? USA, UK, others? And I guess this is an attempt to just narrow down your sources. Deborah, if you go to a country, will you get better coverage than another country?
I think it depends on the science you're talking about. I work with the World Federation of Science Journalists. You see, as opposed to in the United States, that a lot of places like Latin America or China or Asia are building up their science journalism forces at the same time that we seem to be pulling ours down. But at the same time, you're going to see really tricky taboo issues, right? I have a friend in South Africa who wrote about evolution and is still dealing with the death threats that resulted. So it's specific to the issue you care about and the politics of the country that you're dealing with. I mean, let's face it, a lot of science coverage is influenced by the culture in which you live.
Mm-hmm. We're going to see a lot of science coverage. I know we're going to be one of these people covering it. The President Obama has been pushing for the renewal of nuclear power, mm-hmm. right? It's going to be a hot topic. People are going to be debating it. How should people look for coverage, let's say, on a very hot topic issue like that? How do you tell people, you know, what to look for? Can you tell people how to, you know, what, Deborah?
How to evaluate the risk?
Yeah, how do you evaluate the risk? How do you evaluate what people are saying about it, whether they have vested interests, that sorts of thing?
Well, I think it's on us to do a better job with that. I mean, one of the things I think we sometimes, speaking for myself and the community of science writers, don't do well is remind people that science, including nuclear science, is a very human enterprise. And many of the players in it do have stakes. We need to provide the stories that actually round out our coverage. And I also believe that hot topics should be covered kind of coldly, so that when I am writing about nuclear power, I step back and I objectively look at all the risks involved. Finally, I really don't like the he said, she said stories either. There's always a point of view that you need to write for and explore. And so the one thing I think we do a disservice to all our readers and listeners and viewers is if we are weighting equally both sides of an argument without qualifying the sources. It's really important for us to do our homework and get in there and let people know what each side of the argument represents.
1-800-989-8255. Let me go to the audience, then we'll go to the phones. Yes, sir.
Hi, thanks for being here. My name is Dan. I work for AAAS, and I recruit scientists and engineers to come and work for the federal government. And one of the biggest challenges that they face in their assignments is communicating effectively about uncertainty to policymakers such that they can make better decisions, so that they can make decisions at all. And I'm curious if the panelists, Dr. Schneider, you've spoken about this before, can talk a little more about how both scientists and science writers can talk about and write about uncertainty so that the public can understand it and accept it, and so that policymakers can make better decisions.
Mm-hmm. Let me just remind everybody that this is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato here at the AAAS meeting in San Diego. You heard the question. Anybody want to tackle it? Stephen?
I think that you have to use metaphors that convey both urgency and uncertainty that people use. Don't use your jargon. In terms of climate, there are things, as I said, well-established, speculative. I use metaphors like buying insurance. 2% chance your house burns down, yet 95% of people can afford it, have it, because you have to look at the consequence as well as the probability. The other metaphor is loaded dice. You know, we have hot and dry and cold and wet. So you're switching some of the cold and wet toward hot and dry, depending where you live. You can use military deterrence and other things. And bell curves, I always use, never show a bell curve, I always use a wheel of fortune. So here are the lucky slots, 1 or 2 degrees warming, not great. And over here are the oh my God slots, 5 degrees, we don't know the answer yet. We're talking about, you know, risk management with the planetary life support system. So tell them the stakes and use metaphors that they absolutely understand in their everyday life, and you can communicate that. What the big problem is, they keep thinking that science is a trial. It is not guilty and innocent. Very often we are not going to know the answer to really critical questions before it's too late to prevent them from occurring, and that we're in the risk management game using, as I said, wheels of fortune for our life support system.
All right, Deborah, did you want to jump in on that?
Yes, I mean, one of the problems you have is that journalism is event-driven, and science is a process. So that one of the things that we need to do better in dealing with uncertainty is convey better the way science actually works, so that people understand that it is an uncertain process instead of just, you know, discovery, 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 solid fact, solid fact, solid fact, solid fact. And that, I think, we're still trying to figure out how to do well. How do you do the theater of a process when an event is so much more naturally wonderful?
Let me get a quick question in. Burke from Orlando here. Welcome to Science Friday. Burke, are you there?
Thanks.
Hi, quickly, please.
I just had a quick question. Like, if my grandmother goes to a website and she sees some information about some new amazing pharmaceutical item, and it's, you know, hyped up as, you know, the best thing ever, it's a little bit concerning that she'll go to this site. It'll be a blog. It won't be, you know, it'll be like, this is, you know, it'll be telling all of this amazing information about this product, yet there's nobody backing it up. There's no company actually associated with that blogger telling, you know, all these amazing things about this product. And she has no real idea, you know, whether or not it's good or not, but it's like a regular person saying, hey, go try it.
Yeah.
Is there anything to protect people like her from, to identify who is the source of providing the money to pay for this blogger to...
I'm actually an expert on this because I get this from my parents all the time, too. You know, so what I do, I'll tell you what I do. I look at 4 or 5 websites knocking down or supporting or knocking down whatever it is they've emailed me to ask about, and I send those back and let them take a look. Again, I think it's that idea that with this new stuff, you have to look at a lot of places to kind of get a sense of what's going on. The other point I was going to make about communicating some of these things is that there's actually something nice about the new media, which is that you now can see the blatantly biased sources in all their naked beauty. So in other words, if you're interested in nuclear power, one of the things you can do is try to look for neutral sites that'll give you the pros and cons and all the things. You can also now look at the nuclear industry site, and you can look at the sites of the anti-nuclear critics and weigh those things in too. You know, it wasn't so long ago that the only people who got to see press releases from the nuclear industry were us. It was secret stuff. It was part of the fun of being a reporter. We got to see all the secret stuff that we would write about. Nobody else saw it. Now everybody can see everybody's press releases. So it's also a good idea to look at the really biased sources.
We have to take a break. We have to say goodbye to Jane Stevens. Thank you, Jane, who's director of the media strategies for the World Company, and that's the parent company of Lawrence Journal World and Six News. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you for having me, Ara.
We're going to take a break. We'll come right back. Stay with us. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. We're out here in San Diego at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, talking about communicating science with Deborah Blum, Paul Rayburn, Stephen Schneider, and joining us now to talk about a project to get more science and scientists into the movies and on television is my next guest, Jennifer Ouellet. She is director of the Science and Entertainment Exchange, and that's a program of the National Academy of Sciences, and she's here in San Diego. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Do I read this correctly? Is this how scientists do what? How are you going to help science?
Well, we actually recognize the power of Hollywood to inspire people, to inspire imaginations. When I was working as a journalist, I always would talk to scientists about what made them want to become a scientist, and invariably it would be a book they read, a movie they saw, or someone they met. But in general, it was this entertainment industry. It has the power to reach people with a very strong, inspiring message, and it can get across very broad, general messages about, you know, the good or bad of science. And so this is a way of doing that by essentially finding a way to get entertainment people and scientists in a room together and talking.
So they pitch ideas each other? Or if someone, let's say, is out there writing a screenplay about string theory, they can come to you and call your office and get help from a scientist or something like that?
Yes, we will match them up with a string theorist. And believe me, we've gotten those questions. We've had requests for laser scientists, for neuroscientists, for an expert on the star-nosed mole, believe it or not. And that's part of what we do, definitely. We want to get these people in a room together. And one of the things that we do, particularly on film, because you have some lead time there, we did this for Tron Legacy. We did it for director Ridley Scott on a project he was working on and a couple of others. We basically, they bring in the producer, the director, a couple of writers, and we bring in three or four scientists, and they sit there and they brainstorm for an hour, usually about either a couple of key plot points that really rely on science. And you get the creativity of both sides, and it's wonderful.
How do you view the Big Bang Theory?
That's bad.
Which has a lot of science in it.
And the science, it is the best physics on television. But the portrayal of physicists, which I'm sure is what you're getting at here.
No, I'm not. I think it's smack on.
So you've met some physicists.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a wonderful series. We know the technical consultant on that. He's a physicist at UCLA named David Salzberg. I use those clips all the time. It's one of the few places where you can actually hear jokes about slope of an inclined plane and weird effects and time travel and have it done accurately.
You know, Leon Letterman, you know, physicist, spent 20-odd years going back and forth to Hollywood. I used to talk to him all the time about this, trying to convince people like Norman Lear, people like that, to put science into a series. Instead of having it in a hospital, why not have it in a laboratory and do all that stuff that they do? But at least you're watching scientists work.
Right. And I think it could go a long way to changing perceptions of scientists in particular. If you look at television now, you've got female scientists. You've got them solving crimes. CSI is all really attractive people doing science in a lab. And, you know, yes, their DNA results come back in 2 minutes rather than 2 weeks. But
Well, let me ask a scientist, Stephen. How do you react? Is this all good for science to see shows like this?
It's good when it's done well. For many, many years, I was on, and still am, on advisory boards to Hollywood, and I keep trying to tell them that it's not so much your job to tell the science story, but to tell the science process, because that's not where people are going to get their science information. So you need an accurate thing. In fact, I was on an Academy review panel in the 80s where we set up Planet Earth, and I was the only guy that could talk to the producers and the scientists, because the scientists wanted it to be, quote, accurate, and the producers were interested in production value. And it turned out there actually were compromises you could make to make it work. So if your program is trying to get them to talk upstream, not after they're already committed to their storyboards and all the other things, then we have a chance that we can get science in. So you want no mistakes, and show the process honestly, and people find out, hey, you know, those guys are trying pretty hard and they're doing a good job.
He raises a very interesting point. It's one of the reasons that I like working on the film projects, because we get involved very early in the development process. And at some point, you're just fact-checking. At some point, the story's set in stone, and it's woven into the fabric of the narrative, and you actually can't separate it at that point. It's too late. But if you get involved early on in these discussions, okay, maybe the movie ultimately doesn't get made, but there's been an interaction, a relationship there.
You get a feeling that these things run in cycles. We're now in a cycle where physics is king.
Physics
everywhere.
Is the new black.
Yeah. Who would have ever thought that physics, apart from Star Trek and the holodeck and all things like that that were going on?
But they're not on policy relevant stuff. I mean, the day after tomorrow, it was a potboiler. I mean, how can you have temperatures changing degrees per second? It violates thermodynamics. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really disastrous that they couldn't have gotten that right. Supposing they said per weeks, would have been just as effective. I mean, that's the kind of thing where we have a much better job to do. We have to get in there early, before they wreck it, because then they just embarrass us.
It's interesting that movie came up during our discussion. We just had a session on this, and I've actually met the screenwriter of that movie, who knows the science very, very well. He was caught in the middle. He had to please a director, Roland Emmerich, you know, who wants big special effects. One of the things that our other speaker, Sid Perkowitz, brought up during our session was, okay, yeah, the science was ridiculous in terms of the timescales on which it happened, but it did have a measurable impact on people's attitudes towards climate change. People came out of there with a sense of immediacy and urgency that they did not get had they happened to see Inconvenient Truth.
Now, you've written a book called The Physics of the Buffyverse.
Yes, I have.
Is that because you believe also there's, like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the physics of that, or is that what that's like?
You know, a physicist dared me to do that book. He said, you can't do it. It's vampires and monsters and magic. How could you possibly find science in Buffy the Vampire Slayer? But I explained it in terms of world building, and we talked a little bit again about that earlier today. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're building a fictional world, and you need your audience to buy into that. You need it to believe them. So it has to be plausible, and one of the ways you make it plausible is you have rules, you have conflict, you have limitations, and you have to decide in advance what those rules are. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go to the audience here. Yes, it's standing there very patiently.
Okay. Well, my name's Chris Mooney, and I'm, among other things, a blogger. And my blog, whenever I write about climate change, is overwhelmed by hundreds of anti-global warming people. And so that's what my question is about. It seems to me that the web is a wild, wild west in terms of the conveyal of information. And right now there's three anti-global warming blogs in particular, Climate Depot, What's Up With That, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the third, but they basically drive massive amounts of traffic. So how, and we've got good sources of information about climate, but we've also got bad ones that are very popular. How do you ever overcome the fragmentation of audiences that exists with this new media? Do you just have to shout louder, or is there something structural that can be done, or is it always going to be Conservapedia versus Wikipedia in terms of what the truth is?
I mean, are you ever going to change anybody's mind? I think is another way of looking at that. You can get the other people to look at the other. Deborah, do you want to jump in there?
I was actually thinking of it differently, Chris, which was that we can reach different audiences with blogs and with our approaches than we get to before. One of the things that really interests me in science communication is how do we get out of our science literate box? What about those people who often do end up driving the discussions, who ran away from science a long time ago? How do we get to them? And so I am now a true crime blogger, which is an unusual thing for a science journalist to be, but I just did a book, which is a very CSI book, and I got invited to write about the science of crime for Women in Crime, Inc. And I thought about this really seriously. You know, I'm now looking at all of these horrible murder stories daily. I'm worried about who I'm going to be at the end of the year. But I also think this is a great opportunity for me. I can reach people with fascinating things about science who would never read a science blog. So I, you know, I see that there's this Wild West, but that has these wonderful outposts that we can take advantage of.
Paul, did you want to jump in?
I was just going to say one thing about all these things, whether it's climate or the latest new miracle cure or whatever it is. Excuse me, where there are all kinds of people who are on a kind of an anti-science kick. I'm afraid that a lot of scientists and smart people like all of us in this room often think that if only those folks knew what we knew, they would, of course, agree with us. And I don't think that's true. And so my question is, with these things, which I think is a question that isn't asked often enough, which is, why are these people so vehemently anti-climate change? Now, we know why the utility industries might be, or the coal industry. That's easy. That's not an interesting question. But all these people, whether they're Tea Partiers or whoever they are, why do they feel the way they do? And if we want to have more discourse with them and weed out some of the junk, the first thing we need to do is figure out why they're so ferociously, you know, vocal mm-hmm. about what they're saying.
Stephen? Yeah,
if my hundreds of emails, which I'm sure Chris Mooney, who's just asking a question and has written on this topic in his books, are any indication, the typical line, and you would not believe the vulgarity and even violence threats. It's amazing. Only in the last 2 years since the Tea Party types decided that their, you know, their imagined version of the destruction of America allows them this kind of radical, you know, ugly behavior. What they generally say is, you communistic dupe of the United Nations who wants world government to take away our religious and our economic freedom. So they live in a mythology. They get it reinforced by people who take out-of-context quotes to convince them. And then they sit there, and it's very, I'm sorry to say this, red state, blue state specific. And, you know, if you want to take the world and oversimplify it, you have people in two kind of value systems, faith, trust. Don't give me evidence if it's going to knock me off the pin, and doubt, test, which is our value system. You change any opinion when you have new evidence. I don't know if you're going to be able to reach that 25%. You have to go for the middle that still has a mind that's open, and that way you can get a majority in a democracy, except if it's a 60% Senate.
Let me see if I can get a quick call in on the phone. Bill in Chelsea, Michigan. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was wondering about the tendency for some scientists, especially in paleontology and even in the environmental movement, to run to the media with their latest theory, and then if it turns out to be wrong, it hurts the credibility. Have you thought about that at all?
Stephen, can you comment on that?
Well, I don't mail things out. I have colleagues at Jim Hansen who do. Most scientists are really lousy public relations agents, and they have their university or their lab PI information, public information officers, trying to get them to do that stuff. Most people come to us. You know, when it comes out in Science or News or wherever it is, whatever the magazine is, you can bet that it's going to be on a blog immediately, at least a blog that's sympathetic, and then you're going to get phone calls. What I keep telling most scientists, it's not your job to report your stuff. It's your job to report the field, and if they ask you about your stuff, go for it.
Well, this is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flato in San Diego. We're on the road today. And Deborah Blum, did you want to comment on that?
Well, does anyone believe that science has only good ideas and that only the only scientists who come forward and want to get their research out are the geniuses? And so it's, in fact, a logical part of the process to have people who aren't the most brilliant scientists in the world trying to get their ideas out there. And the responsibility for dealing with that, I think, comes back to science journalists. Your question earlier about, do we keep enough good, trained science journalists who can put this in the proper context? We still need gatekeepers out there, actually. We still need people trying to put this work in context.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Stephen?
Very quickly on that, I completely agree, and I've got to put down the blogosphere. The blogosphere is one of the worst places to go for information, because unlike Paul and others, most public people are not going to spend 3 hours a day doing this. We really need to reestablish the mainstream media in putting some specialists back in who can smell the north end of a southbound horse, because most general assignment reporters can't, and certainly their editors can't.
Let me ask Jennifer, I don't have time for a last question. This afternoon, the National Science Foundation is going to announce a new collaborative partnership with the University of Southern California School of Cinematic Arts. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard about that. I don't want to like jump ahead of the announcement. I think it's fantastic. We've worked in the past with the National Science Foundation. I think anything we can do to help bridge these gaps.
And it's basically aimed at helping scientists to create visual items. You know, mm-hmm. everybody's thinking visually these days.
Yes, they are.
So that they can get their message. Somebody asked, how do you get their message out?
And also to think narratively. I mean, I was thinking of that when I was hearing you guys talking about how, you know, that you just can't reach these people. You're assuming that if they just know the facts, they'll change their minds. And it's not just about facts. It's about emotion. It's about story. And that, I think, is one way in which we can learn from Hollywood. I mean, they know how to change minds.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, you're shaking your head.
I'm agreeing. I think that's absolutely
violently
right.
Up in
violently.
So you have to, the scientists have to know how to tell a good story, too.
Yes, that's exactly right.
That's why Deborah and I have a job.
So are you hopeful for the future, Stephen? You're sort of, do you think it's going to get better or just going to get more polarized?
Well, I wrote Science as Contact Sport because I thought that I could get people to understand the process, and when they understood the process better, they might actually be able to, as I said, figure out who's giving it to them straight. Unfortunately, since I, you know, published the book in November, it's gotten worse with these phony gates that pick on bits and pieces and don't give you perspective. I'm not optimistic. I'm sorry.
Well, would any of you then encourage students here at the AAAS meeting to become science journalists? Are they going to have jobs, Deborah?
Absolutely. It's still a great profession, and it's still a needed profession. We see all kinds of new opportunities online, new publications, new ways of telling stories, growing audiences internationally as at home. And it's necessary because science literacy is necessary. And people who are able to really get out there and make science compelling and real and important are an essential part of what we need to do today.
Paul?
Yeah, no, I think it's the Wild West. You know, stake your claim. There are going to be gold dust in a lot of those streams. We don't know which ones, but there are going to be a lot of jobs. You're going to have to work for nothing or for lousy pay for a long time. But, you know, tough. We did that, too, when we were working for newspapers.
And Jennifer?
I actually agree with them. I think this is a yes, there's this huge change, and you know, I am, in some instance, watching my profession go down in flames, but only in its past incarnation. You know, it's the metaphor of the phoenix. It will rise up again, and there are a lot of opportunities. When you tear everything down again, once during the rebuilding process, new structures will emerge. Finding out what those are going to be, that's kind of part of the adventure.
Yeah. Well, we started the conversation. I want to thank all of you for taking time to be with us today. Deborah Blum, professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Her new book is called The Poisoner's Handbook. Paul Rayburn is a science writer. He blogs for the Knight Science Journalism Tracker. Stephen Schneider is a climatologist at Stanford. His new book is Science as a Contact Sport. And Jennifer Willett is director of Science and Entertainment Exchange, and she has a new book, The Physics of the Buffy Verse. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Sure.
Thank you. Our program is produced by Christopher Taliata, senior producer Ned Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Sarah Handel is our director in Washington. Flora Lichtman, our producer for digital media. Shelley Du Bois is our Sci Arts producer. Alicia Bayak is our Spanish language producer. Neil Rausch, our technical director in New York. Our audio engineers here today are Kevin Waite, Patrick Murray, and Drew Reynolds. We also had help from Scott Cameron, John Asante, and April Failing, screening our phones back there in Washington. Thank you for being so helpful today. And we had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. You can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're podcasting and blogging all week and Twittering and tweeting and everything else we can think of doing in this Web 2.0 world. If you have any suggestions, we're more than happy to take them from you. I'm Ira Flatow in San Diego.